Good evening and welcome to Radio Alchemy, where we fuse the fringe with conventional wisdom. From secret societies to out-of-body experiences, black budget technology to this new world disorder, we want you to join us each week as we look at this thing called life with all the pieces. All right, darling. In this first hour, as we do sometimes, we have on things that maybe are in a language speak, in a media ecology kind of language that you have not ventured and heard much about. There is a whole parallel intelligence out there, one that's wrapped around media, one that's wrapped around our extended senses, and the man who has brought that to you here at KPFK has been my guest, Bob Dobbs. Well, tonight, someone that he has studied greatly, that figures into his cosmology of this amazing system of extended senses that we live in, is with us tonight. And we're going to sit in on an insider's talk about technology, about the human body, and all the above with Bob Dobbs and Arthur Croker. Let me tell you a little bit about Arthur Croker. He is a professor of political science and presently the Canada Research Chair in Technology, Culture, and Theory at the Pacific Center for Technology and Culture. Some of his books that you can find out there, he is a co-author of The Postmodern Scene, also Data Trash, The Theory of a Virtual Class, and the author of The Will to Technology and Culture of Nihilism. The Will to Technology and Culture of Nihilism. I want to thank both our guests for being here tonight, and welcome to the airways, Bob. Bob, are you there, dear?
Yes, Eben.
Fantastic. So always wonderful to have you on here, Radio Alchemy. How are you?
Great. I'm very keen on tonight. I've been wanting to talk to Arthur in this context for a long time.
And Mr. Croker, thank you so much for gracing our airwaves down here and joining us, hanging out late. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's great to be here.
Fantastic. Well, Bob, I know that you have a number of questions that you want to start out with, so take it away.
I want to begin with your book, the new book, The Will to Technology and the Culture of Nihilism, Arthur.
Yeah.
And just taking a sentence, which having read your books for 15 years or more, maybe 20 years, since 1984, it's been 20 years.
Yeah.
You make an interesting statement in the opening pages. You were doing seminars at Boston College, Cornell University, and Concordia, and you say, this is a few years ago, I began with an eagerness to explore the breaking wave of new digital media for their aesthetic, social, and political implications. But as the seminars proceeded, I found my thinking on the, quote, question of technology, unquote, undermined, and my predisposition to theorize new media at the speed of aesthetic light abruptly flipping into its opposite, a desperate need to think the future somehow outside, beyond, and anterior to the question of technology. Perhaps it was listening to students who spoke poetically and passionately about their deep feelings of mourning for that which had been swept away by the bright sunshine of biogenetics. And then you go on. But the interesting thing, Arthur, for our audience who probably has not read your book, you go in and explain this throughout the whole book, but maybe in a, you know, in a simple way, explain what is this change that you're noticing? I mean, basically you say your studies of the digital nerve have moved into the genetic matrix. Maybe you could explain that a bit to us?
Yep. A lot of the work that I've done has really focused a lot, you know, for 20 years on trying to think through the implications of digital culture and trying to say, you know, like really following in many ways the writings of such a wonderful thinker like Marshall McLuhan or another Canadian thinker, Harold Innes and Teilhard de Chardin and others, really trying to think of, you know, the kind of utopian, blissful ways by which the coming to be of electronic culture really does extend human senses, makes possible human community, makes possible really creative forms of human communication, you know, just opens up the possibilities of a digital generation. So, you know, I've done, you know, written about this, done a lot of art in this area and a lot of, you know, collaborative work with the musicians and others, and that's all really good. And what I really noticed, though, is that, you know, when the second stage of the contemporary technological revolution happens, when digital technology combines with the language of biotechnology, it's not so much creating a wired world, but really creating a world in which the wires come inside human beings. And you really can speak in a kind of concrete, material way but actually growing different types of human beings, you know, cloning, xenotransplantation, the whole movement of biopharmacology into bodies. You know, present experiments which are going on in California, funded, for example, by Paul Allen, you know, really to write the DNA of the human brains in 5 years, to go into the human brain and then really to see what kind of improved forms of human intelligence that you can have. But when I began to think deeply as I could about the language of biotechnology, for myself, you know, like it just gave me a real pause and thought. I thought, what is going on with this project of technology? You know, what are we rushing? You know, what are we speeding up towards? And is it possible that as we open ourselves up to a technological future, that there are really fundamental forms of human communication and human relationships and perhaps even the human species, which is being lost?
So in this book, you begin with an update of the first and second wave of eugenics, and now we're in the third wave of eugenics. And you give a dark view of that. Could you explain the third wave of eugenics?
Yeah, the third wave of eugenics. The first two waves of eugenics were, you know, the emergence in Britain and Sweden, the United States and Canada, emergence of, you know, forms of, you know, biogenetics in the language of naturalism itself. The second wave, of course, you know, and this is translated into the social hygiene language, which led to really grisly and horrible sterilization experiments in Canada, the United States, Sweden, many countries. The third wave of eugenics, I think, this is a, you know, like for 50 years, there were relatively few public debates of eugenics because, you know, the fact that the German scientists and the German scientists working with the National Socialists in Germany, like under the rubric of fascism, creating like a eugenically pure Aryan race, adopted just really wholesale the thinking of American biogenesis. So this, you know, put a pause in, you know, the kind of utopian discourse of eugenics. Then after 50 years have passed, suddenly we find ourselves back in a third wave of eugenics, in which eugenics is being justified today, not in really the language of, creating a eugenically purified pure race, but it's really justified in terms of the language of breaking into and improving the human genetic heritage itself, really trying to improve, to provide forms of biopharmacology that will improve human intelligence and human emotions, really facilitate, you know, vast transformative developments in areas like medicine and science itself. It all comes to us in this very cornucopia of utopian language that the coming to be of, you know, the biotech age, you know, is going to usher in the age of, you know, like really fundamental improvements in the human species itself. The argument that I would make, though, is that the reality of this is really completely flipped around. I think that human beings themselves are being colonized by the language of biotechnology. Things like cloning and transplantation and xenotransplantation and thinking of the language of biopharmacology in the form of mood-altering drugs into human bodies themselves is something really to think about, because what we are quickly leaving behind is the notion of a human species. We're just on the verge of, like, the human species for the first time actually beginning to creatively recreate itself. The question I would ask then is, are we really prepared for the accelerated form of change this will happen, that this will bring about? And secondly, are we prepared ethically for leaving the human body?
Right. You have some amazing examples in the chapter, The Digital Eye, near the end of your book. You talk about an artificial tongue has been designed by researchers in Texas. Eventually, the virtual taste bud tongue will be able to distinguish bitter, sour, salty, sweet, and all possible variations. According to the Texas engineers, the electronic tongue relies on compounds that act as sensors, changing color in the presence of certain chemicals. The Texas scientists found a way to attach the sensors to tiny beads that are then placed in microscopic cavities machined into a silicon chip. Taste buds on a chip. You're talking about our senses splitting off from our body and creating their own worlds meshed with machines and chip technology.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think it's really the meeting of artificial intelligence and much deeper, much more ancient dreams of actually being able to crawl out of the human flesh itself, the creation of synthetic creatures and synthetic bodies itself.
Yes, and there are people that are writing and planning this. It's in certain parts of your last chapters here, isn't it?
Well, yeah, no. That example of the synthetic tongue, which we then did a, you know, sort of like a Dadaist refrain on, you know, data, big
yes.
tongue, and tongue, first language and stuff. That's actually already in existence. Those are used in chocolate factories.
Right.
For quality testing.
And you go on to the ancient taboo, you know, in Hopi and ancient native cultures, stories about mermaids and minotaurs and mutating our form. This has come back.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely it's come back. It's come back in the form of what I would call creation of, like, transgenic bodies. Transgenic bodies are spliced bodies. They're spliced with, you know, they're created synthetically. They're equipped with artificial intelligence. They're formed in terms of their emotions with mood-altering bioforms of biopharmacology itself. They're really recombinant creatures which are crawling out of human flesh, you know, as we speak. I mean, I think the 21st century will be known not as, you know, McLuhan's age of electronic culture, but it'll be really known as the age of the first appearance on a mass scale of transgenic beings themselves, of recombinant beings.
Now, right, and this... Go ahead.
Now, my attitude towards this, you know, as in this book, is fully ambivalent. I think it's really... will to think of this, you know, really decisive and massive technological change and advance. I just say, you know, are we prepared at a fundamental ethical level to think through the consequences of the creations of clones and transplanted human beings and of recombinant transgenic beings. So at the one level, I would ask that question. The second level that I would raise is we have to really think in advance as well. But if you create transgenics, then transgenics also have rights. They also will have a certain form of species existence itself, as clones will have a certain form of species existence. They'll have their own form of singularity. And are we going to be able to cohabit peacefully with them, coexist with them? I mean, is it possible for a human species, which has always proved itself to be, you know, really relatively territorial and aggressive and predatory, to give rise to its successor species, and then find some means of peaceful cohabitation with this companion species, as Donna Haraway would say.
And this just touched on in movies like The Blade Runner. That's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You're talking about implications way beyond the dilemma in that movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, for sure. I mean, Blade Runner is, you know, so brilliant, you know, because when the androids come back, you know, and have such an authentic desire simply to find their creator and find a way of, you know, living for another minute longer. I mean, it's really a film about the sadness over the impossibility of overcoming mortality itself. And you have the Blade Runners, you know, the L.A. detectives, you know, are just really ruthless themselves and hunting them down, hunting the recombinants and the aliens down. But the humanness of the film are, of course, on the side of the aliens, of those who have come back from far-off planets. Remember the very, you know, one of the last scenes of the movie, and Beatty, when he sticks the nail through his hand so he can live a little bit longer, just experience something one sentence long, it says, you know, I've seen things that you have never seen, you know, I've seen flares off, and then he names the planet. See, and that beautiful speech that he actually just sort of made up on the spot.
I've been on the shoulders of Orion.
Yeah. It's truly, truly beautiful. And I thought, well, that movie really conveyed the humanness and the humanity and the, you know, the, you know, just multifaceted character of the transgenics that will come after the human species itself. And I would just ask, is this human species, at least as I've known it, aggressive and predatory and colonial and controlling, really ready to act in any way that's better than the actions of the Blade Runner?
May I ask a question, Bob?
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, real quick. Mr. Croker, in that you are saying that this is the third wave of eugenics, isn't it that very same mindset, this aggressive, territorial kind of mindset that was behind eugenics and possibly behind this third wave eugenics, in a sense, creating this kind of divide and conquer? What is the idea behind trans eugenics when the human body is the ultimate? Everything just tries to mimic it. Everything is approaching it, but is not it. So what would be the reason for that kind of mindset to back a third wave of eugenics?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. I think one thing that's driving the language of biotechnology forward and this new form of eugenics forward, perhaps for twofold reasons. First of all, you know, this occurs like in a real economic context. There are large multinational corporations are going to have phenomenal forms of profit making by the fact that they can actually offer improvements to the human body that were not possible before. Let me just give you one example of this. Like, take like a drug like Viagra, which was, you know, came on the market just only several years ago.
Right.
And it came on as like, you know, like a potency drug for seniors, right? Bob Dole doing his advertisements and things like this. But if you noticed, you know, a student told me yesterday, you know, because I was saying, well, they've been noticing a lot of commercials for Viagra now. They're not aimed at senior citizens anymore. They're much more like a recreational drug of biopharmacology, like a mood-altering drug, in which the drug enters the human body and is used for, you know, at very fundamental levels to really, you know, volatilize human sexuality itself. And he said, yeah, you know, I was in Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, you don't hear any more about ecstasy and things like this. People would just be whispering to you on the street, do you want some Viagra and stuff like this, you know, the drug of, you know, the recreational drug of choice. Well, that's just not an example just about Viagra. An example about, you know, the profitability and this fantastic seduction of biopharmacology itself, of the tremendous seduction and deep fascination with the use of biopharmacology as fundamental forms of mood-altering drugs and really sexual forms of drugs which alter, you know, deep forms of human desire and sexuality itself. So on the one hand, you know, the third wave of eugenics, you know, really offers to facilitate things for human beings and becomes fascinating and seductive. Greater intelligence, greater knowledge, greater, more intensive forms of perception, improved looks, greater athletic abilities, and things like this. The other reason, though, is that there's actually a physical, you know, there's a technological need for an vastly improved human species. Because the speed of technology now moves at such an intense point that the human body can no longer, I believe, keep up to the intensity and to the stresses created by technology. And there's just really a physical need from the point of view of the corporations, you know, the techno-corporate atmosphere environment that's running this, to really create an improved level of human species itself, which is like transgenics. First sign of this, for example, is the United States Air Force, which is just, we've seen about just about the last generation of fighter pilots, because jet planes and fighter planes, they are just literally too fast in terms of the speed of, they overwhelm the speed of human perception itself. And the next generation will be rightly run on autopilot with robots themselves. And fighter pilots, if you talk to them, actually admit this themselves. You know, they're preparing themselves for this. So the point that I would make is that the third wave of eugenics really corresponds to a kind of great evolutionary leap in which the speed of technology moves at such an accelerated pace that it really overwhelms the ability of the human body as we've known it to keep up with it. So at the level of drugs, you get forms of biopharmacology to do fundamental forms of mood alteration and the alteration and molding of human desire itself. And at the level of perception and intelligence, you have forms of biopharmacology is, again, you know, therapeutic treatment, which in fact will produce human beings who will be more fit than us to travel quicker and with deeper perception in a fully technological society. This is not for everyone, of course. You're talking about the lead generations of the next, you know, this millennium.
Okay, Arthur. Now, what's interesting is, as an artist, you say that the new art today that takes on the third wave of eugenics is transgenic art, which rides the digital nerve, to quote your book, to and into the genetic matrix. Can you explain why you see a value to this kind of art or its role as anti-environment or the way it deals with this problem?
Yeah. Well, you had a really great American thinker, Lewis Mumford. Lewis Mumford said that technologies don't come just sort of full bloom, that usually the preparations for them don't are sort of quietly and ways people don't notice for oftentimes hundreds of years in advance. He talked of industrialism, for example. He said, really, you know, the early preparations for industrialism had nothing to do with, you know, political economy or the capitalism of industrialism. It had to do with the organization of religious institutions called monasteries, which literally industrialized our sense of time. You know, routine habits run according to the clock itself, forms of regimented human behaviors. You know, the monastery was a the medieval monastery was like a really early, brilliant and searing example of what would be the industrial factories of the 18th to the 20th centuries. So in just the same way, I think that if we're just on the verge of a momentous evolutionary leap of technology beyond electronic culture to transgenic culture, which is to say to the third wave of eugenics, then I would say that that's probably already been signaled by fundamental transformations which are occurring at the level of culture. We've lived, you know, for many decades now in an intense media culture. In a media culture like radio and television, particularly video games and gaming and computers, is really a recombinant culture. It's a culture where your perception has to move so quickly because you're splicing together without even thinking about it in many, many different streams of information and forms of visualization and ways of understanding itself. I mean, any television viewer's mind is, without their even being aware of it, already what I would call a recombinant mind. You know, a site where many things happen and where, like, literally different forms of knowledge become streamed almost effortlessly itself. And
we do you mean by that, Arthur, that the RNA takes over from the DNA?
Yep, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it comes in advance of it. The mental preparations are done, they're set in, are installed first, and the actual technological change comes later. That's why I think that if we're, you know, approaching the age of biotech and living already in the, you know, just the first intimations of the age of biotechnology, that is, means the preconditions of it have already been set for the last 50 years, really.
Let me remind folks, you are tuned to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. Radio Alchemy, I'm your host, Eben Ray. On the lines, darling, isn't this fantastic? We are sitting in on a deep and broad conversation about technology and about the futures of flesh, it sounds like, with Bob Dobbs, our media ecology angel in New York, and with Arthur Croker out of Victoria. He is the Canadian chair, research chair for technology, culture, and theory, darling. And so we are going to be back right after this break and listen in and continue this conversation on our futures. All right, stay tuned.
Hey, Bob.
Radio Alchemy.
Eclipsing conventional wisdom. All alchemists converge at www.radioalchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
Darlings, Radio Alchemy. I'm your host, Eben Ray. On the lines, media ecologist Bob Dobbs and prolific author Arthur Croker discussing his latest tome, The Will to Technology and Culture of Nihilism. Bob, go right ahead, dear.
Arthur, just before that little break, Mumford's idea of culture preceding technology, for example, the monastery preceding industrial factories, that is McLuhan's idea that he brought up later, the phrase effects preceding causes. Remember, heard of McLuhan talk about that?
No, I haven't, but I didn't know his general idea, and that's true.
Right. Now, what's interesting in your book, though, that you retrieve Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Martin Heidegger as people who were wrestling with these questions, these effects preceding causes.
Yeah.
Maybe you could explain, people, you know, conventional wisdom is Marx irrelevant, but you're retrieving these guys, and you find them more relevant today in the transgenic world than maybe before. Could you explain that?
Yeah. You take a writer like Martin Heidegger. He's a German philosopher, writing in the mid-20th century. He just says, in book after book, he just says, like in his famous essay, The Question Concerning Technology, and other essays like The Word of Nietzsche, and just books, he slowly, patiently, and with, just deep, great depth of thought and with real intensity of thought, he began to think through the consequences of the coming age of technology. And he made no bones about it. He said that technology has always has about it both a danger and a saving power. And it's a danger because for Martin Heidegger, if you leave sort of technology sort of develop, uncontrolled by human willing or by, you know, any kind of collective deliberation on what should be the goals of a culture and society, then Heidegger says that what it will do, because it's a historical project, is reduce human beings to what he called standing reserve. And standing reserve means that you're sort of just waiting around to be mobilized on behalf of the historical project of technology. And that the real value of technology is not use value, but abuse value, that it simply abuses the human species itself. So when you read Heidegger, you know, it's like a really dystopian vision of technology. On the other hand, he's really utopian because he has this really beautiful notion of technology also as the saving power. And he says, really, to live critically today, you have to turn to face the danger, which is to think most, you know, creatively, intensively about the possibilities of a technoculture and try to listen intently to the voices, as he would say, of the hidden gods. You know, what magic, you know, what different forms of mythologies are not being addressed by a technoculture. But for myself, a thinker like Heidegger is just a wise thinker, and a pretty good wise thinker, because he gives advice that we need to develop a new comportment to technology. I mean, McLuhan would be such a, you know, Heideggerian figure, you know, because McLuhan developed, you know, really above anyone, just this comportment towards understanding technology, which just for many generations after McLuhan have so illuminated the world in which we live. So that's Heidegger. Karl Marx is probably worthwhile reading today more than ever. He's really, really worthwhile reading today because Karl Marx really provided a really vital clue to understand how network capitalism works. In the second volume of Capital, Marx had a wonderful understanding of how the process of production worked. His thesis was basically this. He says, you know, the digital commodity form will enter into the process of production. It'll enter, be volatilized, it'll circulate, you know, the commodity form circulates. Then he gave hints about the point where what happens if the commodity form, you know, doesn't really want to come out of the process of production, doesn't want to come out of the cycle of circulation, becomes circulation itself. Now, when I read that, I thought, well, that's like such a brilliant description of consumption economy, the consumption economies within which we work.
Yeah.
In which increasingly, like, the objects of consumption, of consumer culture, are really superfluous to just what is most fascinating and seductive and I think most narcotizing for people about the process, which is just sort of being involved in sort of the speed of circulation itself, where things have to be constantly made and remade, not just clothes on the outside, but if you think of shows like The Swans or Extreme Makeover, real fascination with, you know, actually physically resculpting and re-engineering the human, recutting the human body itself.
I see that. Now, Nietzsche. McLuhan used to say Nietzsche was an early media ecologist.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah.
How do you see Nietzsche fit into this?
Yeah. Well, Nietzsche's the guy. Because Nietzsche wrote this really wonderful book two books have so influenced my own thought. Thus Big Zarathustra. Thus Big Zarathustra, you know, it quickly establishes the keynote problem of modernity. The madman comes into the marketplace and says, I seek God. I seek God. God is dead. We have killed him. We have killed him, you and I. There is blood in our hands. The earth has been unchained from the sun, who gave us permission to wipe away the horizon, who gave us permission to, you know, cleanse the world of its claims to certainty of God itself. So when I read this passage of the madman in Thus Spake Zarathustra, I thought, well, you know, I am many, many thinkers, like Albert Camus in France, many, many thinkers have been so influenced by this, saying that the real problematic of modernity has been established by not so much the death of God, but the fact that God has been deliberately killed by the language of science and by the language of, you know, technology, which sort of just rids the world of the language of mythology, of the language of the ancient gods. So Nietzsche, you know, introduces this problem. And then in another text called The Genealogy of Morals, he then really begins to write out what would be the consequences of living in a culture which would live, you know, would be desacralized, which would triumphantly declare that we are a culture which is finally post-God in some ways, you know, like we're, that we're living at the end of history. and at the end of ancient forms of belief itself. And Nietzsche just gave real warnings about what these technological creatures would look like. He had names for them. He called them the coming age of the gnat maggot man, whose motto would be let the dead bury the living itself. Or he said the blonde beasts of prey would begin to crawl around the world and lead the world. And by the blonde beasts of prey, he meant, you know, the creative leaders of politics and economy and business. And as he said, you know, they will set upon the population like a cold pack of demons, and they will stir up the chestnuts of resentment itself. They will name the scapegoats, and they will name the terms of the table of sacrifice. As I read Nietzsche in The Genealogy of Morals, you know, I really couldn't help thinking that, you know, really this is the contemporary politics that we live in. It's the politics of the war in Iraq, politics of the war on terrorism itself. It's really such an apt historical and political description of the fundamental political tensions which characterize the world today. And isn't it peculiar that at the very beginning of the 21st century, when we're living in a very advanced technological culture, particularly in the United States, you know, which is a technological culture par excellence, at the same time as you have this as one of the lead societies of the world, at the same time, both within the United States and around the world, we also witness the emergence of absolute forms of religious fundamentalism and political fundamentalism, you know, which lead to really forms of ethnic violence and sectarian strife and profound forms of social misunderstandings between, you know, great religious movements like Christianity on one hand and Islamic cultures on the other. Now, we had thought that we'd left that all behind in the Middle Ages, but it just strikes me that, in fact, you know, we live in a world in which there's a curious convergence between the future on the one hand and the past on the other. They're not separated from one another. They in fact, rub against one another, and they aggravate one another.
Okay, now, Arthur, you've laid out the themes of your present concerns. I'd like to cycle back and begin 20 years ago and show how the causes you're concerned about now were laid out in effects of what you were writing. You're a Canadian thinker, and you began 20 years ago with a book on George Grant, Harold Innes, and Marsh McLuhan.
Yeah.
What I found interesting was you talked about they confronted, it was the genius of the Canadian thinker to confront the humans in exile inside the technological dynamo. But you brought up a point which I call the in-between, which I would call the tactile. The characteristic of these thinkers and later thinkers is they look at the in-between. Is that what you mean by bimodernism?
Yep, definitely.
Okay.
And calling it the tactile is really nice. But
sometimes yes.
It's not just the tactile, it's also the virtual.
Yes.
So
this in-between, flesh, machine, all the in-betweens,
mm-hmm.
we have virtualized tactility is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, with that in mind, when you do the postmodern, the Panic Encyclopedia in the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
Do you think in retrospect that was explaining the 80s, or did it prefigure the dot-com world of the 90s, or do you think data trash did more of that?
The data trash would be the 90s. The Panic Encyclopedia, you know, took as its content the 1980s. But I think it was a book which, you know, Nietzsche said of his writings, I mean, writings are posthumous in some ways, you know, that they'll do for a later generation. Now, I'm still living, so the Panic Encyclopedia is not posthumous yet. But I think that the Panic Encyclopedia, in my understanding, is a book unconsciously written about the, you know, post 2000 years, you know, the present decade within which we are living, which is genuinely a panic decade.
Right, because that, I do see themes, even though that opening page talks about these new concerns and the shock of the new genetic matrix, as one reads the book, I recognize themes from 20 years ago, or
yeah.
The Panic Encyclopedia. So you're seeing that the Panic Encyclopedia was unconsciously talking about the 21st century, too.
Yeah, definitely. Because you think of, I mean, you could easily write another Panic Encyclopedia, but I don't like to repeat myself.
Right.
But you think of the decade within which we're living. I mean, panic war, panic bodies, panic genes, panic sex, panic Viagra. I mean, the terms, the themes just suggest themselves.
Right.
So I think for whatever reason, the 1980s, we were able to write this panic encyclopedia, which really attracted a lot of attention, had a lot of readers, and I receive all the time to this day people sending me panic theses. But the age that it really refers to is not so much the 1980s as the present decade within which we're living, which is genuinely a panic decade.
Right. Now, what's interesting, in your book, between the panic encyclopedia and the data trash, the possessed individual, you highlight Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, Baudrillard, Foucault, who else, Barth, and maybe one other I can't think of. Oh, Virilio. Are you obsolescing the Canadian triad of Grant, Innes, and McLuhan? Because you see the French as really dealing with the postmodern or the bimodern. Are you implying that you had to move from the Canadian guidance of the three previous people?
Yeah, no, there's a, ironically, there's a habit of Canadian thinkers. It's true of thinker like Charles Taylor. It's true of thinker like a wonderful thinker from Halifax, Haligonian thinker, George Grant, who's like the Hannah Arendt of North America in many ways, is that you begin writing, oftentimes Canadian thinkers will begin their writing with a distinctly Canadian book. Charles Grant would begin with The Pattern of Politics. C.B. McPherson began with a book called Democracy in Alberta. Grant began with Lament for a Nation Itself, and I began with Technology in the Canadian Mind. But the pattern is that the first book is done unconsciously. You write within, you know, the your autochthonous, within the space that you really can feel within your body itself of a political or an intellectual problem that, you know, captures your passions. I wrote Technology in the Canadian Mind, saying that the Canadian identity has just been shaped so deeply by the question of technology itself. But once having written that, you sort of realize you can't think deeply enough about the culture simply within Canadian culture, because the problematic itself is not really a Canadian problematic. Like bimodernism or identity shaped by the question of technology is not a particularly Canadian problem. It, in fact, refers to something which is much more universal and much more global itself. So really, my second book was a much more general text called The Postmodern Scene, about excremental culture and hyper-aesthetics, which I went to French thinkers, began French thinkers and Germans and American art particularly, began to rub them together and say, really, the whole problem of postmodernism, what I would think of as hypermodernism, is sort of like, you know, like it really just expresses so intensely the language of what happens to human beings when they become like standing reserve before the historical project of technology itself.
And that's surplus flesh. Surplus flesh.
Yes, that's they're the surplus flesh and data flesh. But also the postmodern scene opened up the possibility that in postmodernism itself was in fact the first intimations of a much more ancient form of thought, which in fact began to be playful about the fact that we were finally leaving the prison house of a binary age and really began to think creatively about what the space of the bimodern would be, or the in-between would be. And you begin to play with identity and play with, you know, the previous great polarities of human civilization itself.
Now, that comes up to my next point. Baudrillard has an epigraph, I think it's in The Perfect Crime. He quotes Menippus. And McLuhan talked about himself as a Menippean satirist, as one who mixes media. What you just said sounds Menippean, and their ideologue was Diogenes, and he founded cynicism. And there's so much about the hypermodern or postmodern, that cynical power. So it's interesting that Baudrillard cites Menippus, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, no, that's very nice. And the point would be for me, though, is for Diogenes, not that Diogenes was a cynic, he was a kinic, actually. There's a real difference. Cynicism is what we experience today, you know, like really desolate politics.
Yeah.
And desolate, you know, like the draining of meaning out of any utterance at all. Diogenes, of course, was entirely the opposite. You know, this is really thought from outside, as the French thinker Maurice Blanchot would say. He was a thinker who rebelled from below, and he was a kinic as opposed to a cynic. So I've always thought that my thought has much in character, you know, much in line with that. That it's much more kinical. That is, that it's thought from outside and thought from below. It just tries to open up a space of difference. you know, within the intensity and the sort of the white light of the speed of a technological culture.
KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. Yeah, you're tuned to Radio Alchemy, and it is a freeform show, and it is fantastic to have on these two mighty weights sitting there, and we are just like flies on a wall. Isn't it fantastic? And we're listening in on a discussion with Bob Dobbs, a media ecologist angel out of New York, and a newfound friend, Arthur Kroeker. You can find him out on the web. K-R-O-K-E-R is the spelling of his last name. We'll make sure you get the website addresses, etc. We're talking about, wow, extended senses coming alive, looking back at us, rights for transgenic species. Wow, you guys, amazing stuff. All right, we'll be back right after this break, darlings. Stay tuned. Radio Alchemy.
Eclipsing conventional wisdom. All alchemists converge at www.radioalchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
To Technology and Culture of Nihilism. The author is Arthur Kroeker. He is on the line here along with Bob Dobbs, and they are taking us on a whirlwind tour, high-level talk about technology and what that means to your flesh and to your future. Bob?
Yes, Arthur. I'm going to Spasm, page 53, written 11 years ago, in talking about the kinetic space. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. Now, I cite that because on the next page, page 55, you have an interesting statement here in the role of music. You say crash music exists as a culture smasher, a cultural cyclotron in the era of crash economy, which is to say that culture is not a reflex of a political economy, but that society is now a reflex of key shifts in music theory and practice. Hear that? Society is now a reflex of key shifts in music theory and practice. Music rules in the quantum age because sound moves faster than the speed of light, thus quickly eclipsing history. Study music theory, then, as a laboratory of big transformations in power and economy. They will all have their punk period, their sampler phase, their house music era, their heavy metal economy, their rap aesthetics for the commodified body. It's interesting, Arthur, that though music is the hologram of coherency for our culture, I don't think many economists would see that music theory or fashion trends are really expounding the effects of technology and economics.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. But that's because those disciplines really stand outside any real understanding of what's happening in culture these days.
And you've been living in university for 30 years. Do you get much interest in how you state this in these rigid disciplines, or do you not consider the academia world your audience?
But it's both, right? You know, because I teach in universities, and I love universities, and I think they're like the kind of hyper-monasteries of an age which is entering into a new dark age in many ways. So there are places to be treasured, to be protected. At the same time, I do a lot of my work electronically. So, you know, like we do, Mirror to Reason, myself, and a group of us, we've done for 11 years now, we've done like a journal which it's called C-Theory. And it's an electronic journal, and it has like 25,000 readers, and it has a website which is accessed by thousands of people every day. And that's, you know, when we publish this, now it's really one of the real main media within which we use to publish, which a lot of other people use to publish. It just has really great articles on it. And it's really a fulfillment of, you know, what Marshall McLuhan would say, which is like education without walls. You know, really in a utopian way, trying to use, open shareware and freely accessible Netscape for the possibilities of just, you know, really reflecting on the culture within which we live, within the media itself. So the people that I would just, that my mind would mingle with every day are on a global scale, are musicians and filmmakers, writers, and poets, and hackers, and people working in coffee shops and stuff like this, just from many, many different walks of life. And I think, really, the fact that we are literally living in what Teilhard de Chardin said, the French theologian, said that we would be living in an electronic age, we'd be living in a noosphere, within a form of electronic communication that would be so dense and so streamed and so transparent in some ways. You can literally have, mind travel. You can literally have kind of, mind meetings and mind mergers between people from many different cultures. And it just happens all the time. Happens, like you look at the incredible popularity of, gamer culture itself, in which on a global scale you'll have minds merging, in the act of playing games, and of course sometimes merging for the good and sometimes merging for, violence of perspective in some ways. But the ways in which you can live digitally today mean, like, for example, this morning, you go on, use iSight, and suddenly you have a, discussion about, designing in a new digital Medina with a brilliant designer from Florence, Italy, who's just speaking out of his own lab itself. And I thought, it's incredible hearing from the west coast of North America in Victoria, Canada, talking to a designer in Florence, Italy, who himself comes out of such a deep artistic, tradition of the arts in Italy and in Florence in particular. And you just have, like mind merger in some ways, like it's really stream knowledge that takes place. It's the most, we've already experienced on a daily basis some of the most draconian consequences of network culture. But also I think we also experience on a daily basis some of the most utopian possibilities of it.
Right now, you cited the Jesuit Teilhard de Chardin.
Yeah.
Weren't you began life after high school as a seminarian?
I did, actually, yeah. And
because I found in reading the postmodern scene 20 years ago, or say 17 years ago, that your perspective on St. Augustine gave you an advantage over the run-of-the-mill postmodern writer. It was your discovery that St. Augustine discovered the third term and reconciled the classical contradictions of existence.
Yeah.
Is that come out of your education in the Jesuit world?
Yeah, but not really out of formal training. Because my serious readings and really classical theology and going back to the Desert Fathers, the lost manuscripts of religion, those really things you were forced to do on the side. You'd cover up your reading and pretend you're doing conventional reading. What you're really doing in the reading is you're reading Augustine's De Trinitate, which you recognize immediately as the first kind of code book of, semiology that's put down. And it's talking about a fundamental crisis in Western civilization that to this day has not been solved. So reading St. Augustine for myself, the Confessions and De Trinitate, his work on the Trinity, has been massively influential. And when it came to, postmodernism and posthumanism, those are just really latter-day expressions of a problem that is 2,000 years old. So I've always read that whole debate in a much broader, with a much greater sense of historical perspective, I suppose, in some ways.
Right, but is this third term that St. Augustine discovers and resolves this problem with, is that McLuhan's visual space, the abstract visual space of the phonetic alphabet?
No, it's completely the opposite. This is what Augustine does. Augustine realizes that the world is, he's thinking like in theological and philosophical terms of actually the terms of a secular crisis that had broken out in the world itself with really the beginnings of the fall of the Roman Empire. And on the one hand, Augustine's thinking about the Roman Empire, which is just the empire, like American empire. It's a language, it's the empire of pragmatism and of power, which carries a spear for a weapon, but which at the same time feels about an incredible exhaustion. Some of the commentators of the time would say that, now that we have conquered the empire, now that we have done everything that is possible to do, you know, what are the ends of what we wish to do? You know, what are the goals of our society? And could find no satisfactory answer itself. And Roman Empire then became more capricious. You know, sometimes it engaged in, like, auto-de-fés, in which it began to sacrifice its own culture or sacrifice Christians that they could, you know, massacre, you know, they could, for purposes of for entertainment, the games and things like this. So on the one hand, you had real culture of materialism, which was an exhaustic culture and rapidly became nihilistic. On the other hand, you had Greek culture, a culture of fantastic idealism, which had about it, you know, the voluptuousness of Epicureanism. And so Augustine's thinking about this, and he's saying, well, the two cultures of my life are a culture of sensuality of the Greeks and Epicureanism on the one hand, which has its own sense of exhaustion, and on the other hand, the society of, like, rugged, primitive materialism of Roman culture itself. And Augustine was attracted to Christianity, and this is what his text, The Confessions, is about, as he rolls about in the Garden of Cassiacum, in which he says, you know, I have the desire to believe. I have the desire to believe in a transcendental principle, not visual acoustic space. I have really the desire to believe in God, but at the point where God enters my flesh itself. And for Augustine, the act of conversion was the point where the transcendental principle becomes one with human autobiography itself. I mean, in the Garden of Cassiacum, he says, I not only have the desire to believe, but I actually, against my own desires and against the possibility, you know, my own cynicism to believe, I finally do believe, and he's flooded with the act of faith itself. So the I don't know the act of faith is a vision, the clone's visual acoustic space. It's, in other terms, it's where faith becomes imminent to the human body itself. And that's a great discovery of Christianity, is that it will make the body, the flesh and blood body of the individual human being, a confessional chamber for working out a great crisis of civilization. It's what Augustine says. He says Christians ride the flesh as a nag on the road to Jerusalem. Christians ride the flesh as a nag on the road to Jerusalem. And on saying that, he is not saying that, but what he's really doing is he's solving a great unresolved philosophical crisis that the power cultures of his age could not solve. That was, you know, the really creative force of Christianity itself. And of course, we're living with the consequences of that for the last 2,000 years, really.
Right. Now, I read, and I think it's back in Data Trash, you say the linguistic metaphor for technology, for its coming alive, is not adequate. Would you say that was Derrida's problem? He did not see that. And would you say that Finnegan's Wake, Joyce saw that in Finnegan's Wake?
Oh, that's pretty nice. Yeah, I like this about Joyce. How would you see Joyce in this?
You're asking me how I would see Joyce?
Uh-huh.
Well, that he produced a book that was beyond linguistic intonations. As McLuhan said, it was trying to paint, like a surrealistic artist, the spaces of kinesis and haptic senses and tactility in the visual medium.
Yep.
And that Derrida only goes as far as seeing the underlying acoustic ambiguities of visual space. Joyce went further, and that would be a more appropriate model for a postmodern technoscape than what the semioticians came up, because they use language, acoustic language, as a metaphor for living technology.
Oh, Bob, that's really nice. That's great.
Okay, we'll move on then?
No, I agree with this wholeheartedly, though. It's
really okay, great. But you don't study Joyce yourself, do you?
No, but I'm very interested in Joyce.
Okay, good.
You know what, loves? Darling, we have time for one more kind of quick question. We're right at the hilt, and so one more question, then we try for next time.
Okay, Arthur, to end, in another part in your Will to Technology is about the third wave trend in computing, ubiquitous computing, where technology disappears, moves inside us, and makes us feel maybe superior to it. Is this a kind of seductive reappearance of our bodies, of even though they're mutated, of some kind of
bodies become
balance?
Yeah, that's nice. Well, yeah, seductive reappearance is where bodies become simulacra of a technology that they think is on the outside.
Right.
They themselves become a conditional possibility for the technology. Ubiquitous computing is pretty interesting. It's happened, actually, since the writing of that.
Okay, just some quickies. Mary Louise, your wife, is a big influence on you intellectually, right?
That's for sure.
Yes. Was David Cook the first one who turned you on to the French writers?
No. I'd
you had read them, but he helped you get organized and start off your operation in Canada, right?
No.
Right. And
no, but he didn't.
Beg your pardon?
He didn't. I mean, David and I worked on certain projects together.
But you were already interested in the French writers before you met him?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And that was because you were in Winnipeg?
Yeah, my first teaching position was at the University of Winnipeg, and at that time I really began reading the writings of the French writer Michel Foucault. I remember the first text I used in the first class I taught was Discipline and Punish.
Right.
I used that text, and I began to think, well, what are the implications for Manitoba? And of course, Manitoba is really a Foucauldian territory because they hung their first leader, Louis Riel. So we began to do, with students, we began to do archival research.
Darling, I'm sorry. Oh, no, I'm sorry, sir. Finish your statement.
Yeah, well, we began to do research into a history of cruelty, which is usually not told in the official story of Canada.
Well, this is something that we are just going to have to pick up, because I think we're living in the presence of cruelty. And maybe you guys have a nice biopharmaceutical that can help us get through this here. And so I want to thank so much Bob for getting Arthur Croker and for putting this together and having such a great high-level discussion about things I know that mean so much to you, Bob, about this technosphere we're in and its meanings for our bodies. So, Bob, I want to thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Evan, for making this possible.
And Mr. Croker, dazzling. How fantastic to, listen to your brain at work and, have it come here in L.A. We hope that we can do this again. Would you be willing to come back?
Oh, definitely. It's a lot of fun.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Great. And thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Do you have a website, Mr. Croker, real quick?
Yeah, the best website would be www.ctheory, C-T-H-E-O-R-Y. .net.
There it is, darlings. ctheory.net.
Yep.
Okay, darlings. All right. Until next hour, stay tuned. And thanks for being up late. And again, thank you, Bob. Thank you, Arthur.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for the second hour of Radio Alchemy on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Bye.